Welcome to Extroverted Developer, a new podcast about computer programming and technology. I'm Jim Wallace.
I'm Ben Gunderson.
And today we have very special guest, author of Programming F Sharp, Chris Smith.
Hello.
Hey, Chris.
How's it going?
So you've just finished the second edition of this book?
That is correct.
Okay.
Just a few weeks ago, I sent it off to O'Reilly to begin the long and arduous process to get it printed.
Wow, they're actually...
Well, I guess it's not long and arduous. There's just
a lot of lead
the process
time.
Of... Yeah.
Okay. All right. So I've never written a book, and so I'm very curious. What is it like to write a book for O'Reilly?
Time-consuming.
Okay.
It's interesting because... If you may be an expert in some sort of area or technology or API, mm-hmm. and it's very challenging to try to distill that into not only its smallest subset that's useful to another human being, but also to communicate that as effectively and clearly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And writing programming F#, the hardest part wasn't writing about functional programming in the F# language, but finding the right way to organize the book so that you can, introduce one concept and then continually build on top of that until you get to the very end and everything that there is to know about the language.
And there's such a big difference between writing a book that's how to do something or how to work something, like whether it's programming or, carpentry, as opposed to fiction, right? I mean, one you do because...
Yeah.
Because it's an art form, writing, but the other you do because you're actually, it's academic, you're trying to... You're advocating for something that you want other people to use. I mean, you wouldn't mm-hmm. write it if you didn't want other people to, follow in your footsteps to some extent.
An exercise I always ask people, when they ask me about what it's like to write a book, I say, "How many tech books do you have on your bookshelf?" And they'll mm-hmm. say, maybe 30 or something. And I say, "How many authors of those books can you name?"
Zero. Chris Smith.
Yeah, okay, one, great.
Right.
And I think that,
Chris
in a nutshell,
sells.
Is...
They're all named Chris.
Okay. Douglas Crockford.
All right.
Yeah, but that's all I get.
Crockford, okay. But the point is that if you get hit 20%, you're doing well above average.
Right.
And mm-hmm. and that, in a nutshell, is the nature of, tech book publishing.
As opposed to fiction.
Not so much.
Everyone knows J.K.
Yes.
Rowling.
Yeah, it's not who you are, but it's... what you're writing about and how timely that topic is. A lot of, it surprises a lot of people to know that if you want to get a publishing deal, you just need to ask. I sent an email to O'Reilly on a Friday that was like, "Hey, I work on this thing called F#. You might be interested in like publishing a book about it. Let me know what you think." And they're like, "Yep, sure. I'll update your proposal and we'll get it approved next week. Have a nice weekend." and that was it,
And is there some kind
genesis.
Of is there some kind of like peer review process for a tech book like this, where someone is like, "Yeah, this is a this is accurate, and we'll make
when
people
this book
better
came
programs.
Out." I don't even know how they would know that.
Yeah. So I mean, it seems like you are the best person to ask about F# and programming in F#. Is there anyone out there who could? Did you have someone else read the book and say, "Yeah, this is right. This is, how'd that work?"
I did. So normally books, they go through a tech review process where you find other, people who are very knowledgeable in an area and have them kind of read and comment on individual chapters, which for programming F# was, people on the team, some mm-hmm. of the people who became, F# MVPs. Every once in a while I would find someone, a friend of mine who was knowledgeable about, programming, but not necessarily F#. And I'll be like, "All right, don't look at the syntax. Just tell me if these concepts make sense."
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you as a competent technical person can, make heads or tail of what I'm trying to describe. You do as best of a job as you can to try to get, expertise in the subject area. But again, you're doing this years, before, in F# case, years before the language was actually released and in Visual Studio.
Right.
And
right.
so it can be very challenging. A trend that other writers have done is to put their books online in like a wiki form while they're writing
yes.
it. I believe the Real World Haskell guys did this. And that way, it's available. People can not only read it and have the material while you're writing it, which is much more useful, but also to provide edits and corrections, you know, months or years before it actually gets sent off for publication.
I think some even business books are starting to do things like that. Like, didn't the 37 Signals guys do that with Rework? Or
I'm not sure.
Starting with those. But yeah. That's pretty cool. And does O'Reilly organize this process at all, or is this all up to you?
I think you could probably work with O'Reilly to figure something out. For programming of Sharp, I think O'Reilly was pretty hands off.
There's not I'd an F Sharp guy at O'Reilly who's like, you know, has to sign off on your book.
Yes, there's the .NET, you know, book editor.
Right.
Who signs off on it.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. But, you know, O'Reilly publishes hundreds of books each year on, you know, a wide array of technologies and does different things for these different technologies. Like, you know, some books are written in, say, that wiki format, or, you know, they try going after different markets different ways. It's very interesting to see how, you know, O'Reilly is one of the more innovative publishers, is evolving and adapting in the face of, you know, just people don't write books or read books anymore, or buy books anymore.
Right. It's all electronic EPUB format and things like that.
Or just people blog, right? Or tweet.
Yeah, I see with a lot of the latest technologies, like CoffeeScript, which is sort of like the compiler, the JavaScript compiler and things like that, like...
Mm-hmm.
The only way to find out information about that is on blog articles and things. There's no book for it because the technology is just changing too fast.
And so many people Google the problem if they have, you know, if they have an error message or something, they Google the issue and, they don't pick up a reference book and flip through it to find the problem. You know, their blog articles are, you know, are searchable, right?
Authoritative.
Yeah.
But I would claim that despite, you know, writing a book being, you know, very time consuming and you know, very arduous, it's still a necessary thing in the world.
I agree.
Because you know, reading blog posts is it's one thing to know how to solve a problem, but you really need someone to editorialize, you know, here's the bigger picture, right? Here's why you should do something. Here's how to avoid these sorts of pitfalls. Because if you go to Stack Overflow, a lot of people ask questions, how do I solve this specific problem in front of me?
Mm-hmm.
When really there should be, somebody saying, okay, well, here's how you don't get into this problem, right?
Yeah.
Like, don't do it that way.
Right. That's the biggest problem I have learning new languages, or like learning new Ruby on Rails and things like that. While the tutorials are interesting, they don't tell you how, like a blog post about Ruby doesn't tell you how you should write Ruby. It just tells you, like, it enumerates the features of Ruby,
right.
Which...
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
But a book can give you the overall, most Ruby developers do this.
Well, many blog posts are opinionated, but they're not necessarily, you know, they don't give you the full, like, the full feeling of a language necessarily in a single blog post.
Yeah, that was specifically one of the things I tried to address with the second edition of the book, is because the first edition was very much, you know, here's the syntax, here's how you would use it, have fun, and didn't try to, you know, mention, well, here's how you would use this, or you probably would favor this feature instead of this other one, in order to express this idea. And so I try to add a little more guidance on that sort of stuff. But
great.
You know, the best thing you can do for anybody who's curious about learning a language, for example, F#, is just do it. Like, it's you need to give yourself license to write terrible, awful code that you'll hate later. Just to get the ball rolling.
Yeah, right? I think Jared, in his episode, he said that he started with F#. He wrote his first thing, and he showed it to, I don't know, Don Symes or somebody like that. And he's like, great, good job, but you didn't use any of the features of the language. He essentially wrote...
Nice. C# code in F#.
Right.
But, you know, he still gets credit, and... You know, That experience will, as you tiptoe, you know, into the waters, eventually he'll learn, hey, it's easier if I use this, write it this way instead of that way. And that's how you learn anything, you know. And I think that can't be said enough, is give yourself license to fail at something, just to get the ball rolling.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you can't decide whether you like something or not until you get over the fear of doing it for the first time. I mean,
yep.
From programming to skydiving, you know, you have to. I actually have a question about the about kind of the user experience of a programming book, being a user experience guy. Rather than about the actual contents of the book, how do you structure as the author of a programming book, how do you structure the book and with an understanding of how it's going to be viewed in all these different mediums, from, you know, like someone who's going to be reading it on an iPad or their phone, or, you know, obviously the print version, the, you know, whoever's responsible for laying out the book. I mean, I know Crockford, and I read The Good Parts Again recently, and so it's kind of fresh in my mind, has those what they call them, railroad diagrams.
Of the syntax?
Right, of the syntax. Okay. And they're all these kind of, but they're all sort of just images embedded. I read it on my phone, so I was constantly like turning my phone sideways so I could, you know, see the whole image like expand. How do you address conceptual issues like that that aren't necessarily text based? Like you're like showing large equations or
There are so many problems or things to worry about in writing a book that's kind of on the near the bottom, right? I don't think I've ever wondered how is this figure going to look like on an iPad, you know, without a Retina display. But I will say that to write the book, I just used Microsoft Word, and O'Reilly has like an add-in that does all the formatting and sets it up so that it's easier for them to kind of convert it to their own format. And there's a wide array of ways to format, you know, notes, lists, bulleted lists, code in italics, you know, have the little notes on captions or the warning captions, and, you know, being able to use these different formatting options to make, you know, text pop out or stand out in different ways.
Right.
And I try to take as advantage of that as much as I could, just because, you know, when you're skimming through the book, just using as much different formatting as possible can be beneficial.
Right. And did you get to decide on things like typefaces, or is that all kind of an O'Reilly standard where you have to use, you know, the body?
I'm sure if I brought it up, yeah, I could probably have asked for something, but, you know, I didn't have any opinions, and so I assume they just went with their standard, you know, this is our brand.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, I wonder if what would happen if you asked to have your book published in Comic Sans, like really pressed it, like how far you would get.
One of the book layout guys would just come up with like a pitchfork and like chase you out of the building. A book, in a way, is like a brand in itself, right? I mean, you also wouldn't want to create a completely new book because people might not, you know, they wouldn't. You'd have to come up with a new title, and, you know, your title sounds pretty good.
Yeah. Yep, I want to learn how to program F Sharp. Right. This is the book.
Yeah, that seems. And actually, I think you're the best person to teach programming for F Sharp because you were the primary tester on the F Sharp team in Visual Studio?
I don't think that was my official title, primary, but
it was something like Supreme Commander Overlord of functional programming.
Yes, there we go.
If I recall from the address book.
Yes.
God Emperor of F Sharp.
Level 60.
When I was working at Microsoft on the F Sharp team, I was a SDET, or Software Design Engineer in Test, which means that it's my job to ensure quality. So I spent a lot of time reading the language spec, trying to make that clear, writing very obtuse programs and finding ways to crash the compiler, and so on and so forth. And so my knowledge of F-Sharp is really about trying to use it, understand it very well, and try to poke at the corner cases of the language. And so in addition, having not received a PhD in, you know, computer science or functional programming, I think that also means I try to make the material as approachable as possible.
Yeah, I do have to compliment you on that. Reading your book, it's very, very approachable, very easy to understand. And you're not, I think a lot of authors have a problem of being too wordy, and you say things very concisely and very clearly, and I appreciate that. I really do.
Thank you. Yeah, that was actually a very intentional thing when I set out on writing the book. In college, my roommate bought a book on XML because he was like, oh, yeah, let's learn about XML. It's a new thing.
Sure.
And this book, I swear to God, was like 1,000 pages long. Like, it was huge. And it was about XML, a concept that you could probably explain in maybe a paragraph.
Maybe a blog post.
Yeah, maybe a blog post. I mean, the book itself went on to detail, you know, XSD and XPath and DTD files and this and that. But, you know, at the end of the day, no one's going to read that 1,000-page tome,
mm-hmm.
Maybe as a reference. But, you know, you're really doing a disservice to every person who tries to read it by just making it so long. And so I intentionally tried to make the book very short and concise so that, you know, if you want to review a concept or be introduced to a concept, you know, go wild.
Yeah, fantastic.
That having said, it doesn't do a good job trying to you know, provide a lot of, you know, real world in depth examples,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that you know, unfortunately hasn't been addressed in the second edition. Just to keep it short.
Okay,
what's the adoption for F sharp like? I mean, I'm not having worked in kind of, you know, that corporate, you know, environments in a while. I'm not really familiar with it. I don't know anyone who programs in it on a daily basis. But is this a
VS Vim is written in F sharp,
right? Yes.
yeah. That's all you need to know.
Yeah. Right. That's a good question. I don't even know if you had numbers for it before you left Microsoft that are publicly available.
Yes. I did not have numbers then, and I don't have numbers now.
But
I do know that the people who do use F sharp are very happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, certainly adoption has been steadily improving, right? I think the challenge is for Microsoft is trying to figure out how to position F sharp, because success for this language isn't you know, trying to get mass adoption like, say, C sharp. Okay, you know,
right.
A wildly successful F sharp product is, you know, maybe 10% of all .NET projects contain one corner that is written in F sharp. Because it's about emphasizing.
I was going to say, you bring up a really good point there, which is that one of the major strengths of F sharp is that it's completely interoperable with the other .NET languages. And so you can write one component that lends itself very well to functional programming and link to that component from your C sharp. And
Exactly. Actually,
the first part of your book is all about that, which I thought was great, because I think that's what most people will do.
Mm. And that's a strength of the .NET framework in general. It's just
the polyglot of languages. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the vision of a common language runtime wasn't quite realized until there were multiple languages running on it.
Hmm.
You know, you can say VB and C sharp are different languages, but for all intents and purposes, they do the same things. They have the same sets of concepts.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference is, you know, syntactic sugar here and there. And so F sharp being on the .NET platform and as a viable first class citizen is really about, you know, realizing that vision and having, you know, choices. And so with a wider array of tools that you can use to write .NET applications, you know, hopefully you can be more effective.
Okay.
That's part of the position.
All right. So there's probably many of our listeners who, like me, are not super experienced with functional programming. Maybe we should talk about a little bit about the basics of functional programming and then talk specifically about F sharp in more detail.
Right. Yeah. As a front end guy, the only functional programming I do really ever is in JavaScript. And JavaScript mm-hmm. is a terrible language. So, you know, I'm definitely interested in what a good functional programming language looks like.
Okay, so let's start with the differences between functional, like programming in a functional style versus programming in a procedural style or an object-oriented style. Let's talk about what makes a functional programming language a functional programming language.
Sure. I'll take a tack that's a little different from a lot of, you know, what is functional programming discussions, and that I will define it as functional programming is a set of design patterns.
Okay.
Okay. It's, you know, not anything that's mind-bending or crazy wild that has never been seen before. And so think about object-oriented programming.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that, you know, super well in C-sharp or Java and maybe even C++. But in truth, you can do it write object-oriented programs in C as well. Just there isn't, you know, syntax support for it, and it looks kind of wonky, but you can do it. You can use classes and interfaces as concepts in C.
Right, because you can create a structure and a pointer to a function in the structure and have the data and the functions encapsulated, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. And you can do the same sorts of things for, you know, functional programming in any a normal programming language.
So okay, in C, you can have functions that take functions as parameters, et cetera.
Yes, yeah, okay. And what a functional programming language is typically one which has syntax support for a few specific concepts.
Okay.
Those being higher order functions, which are functions that take other functions as parameters or return functions as return values.
Okay.
And C# can do this with, you know, func and action objects. JavaScript can do this as well. And so you can, I think it's fair to say that, you know, C# and JavaScript are both functional programming languages, even though they're not traditionally thought of that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair.
So you know, once you think about functional programming as just a set of design patterns, well, then understanding what those patterns are is very straightforward. So there's passing or taking and receiving functions as parameters as one way to, you know, use the functional style. Another one is immutable objects. So okay. Once you construct something, you try not to modify it. And that's just, you know, some discipline on the programmer's part. And for functional programming, that makes it easier to do the sorts of function composition and data transformations that are typical in functional programs.
Because there's no side effects.
Yes. Yes. So, you know, in an imperative language, you're typically telling the computer what to do every step of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Do this first, then do that, then do this other thing. In a functional programming language, you're not telling the computer what to do or how to do it. You're just saying, you know, here's what I want to have happen. I'm gonna drop this piece of data into the first function, then something's gonna come out. And because of that, there are no side effects. You know, the only thing that happens once you put data in is that some new data comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you can glue multiple functions together to, you know, create a sequence of transformations. Okay. So you can kind of line up multiple functions together and just put one piece of data in. It'll, you know, go through all these other functions, and then one piece of data will come out.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Ben?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
You explained it very well. Now JavaScript is a scripting language, right? So as opposed to a compiled language, and there are strengths and weaknesses to that approach as well. I guess probably mostly weaknesses in terms.
Let's not hate on JavaScript. It's a good language. It does its job very well.
It does its job very well. That's a great way of putting it.
Yes, that's true.
So now that we know like sort of what functional programming languages are, and we know a couple examples, JavaScript, F#, Clojure is one on the Java side, and mm-hmm. What are functional languages particularly good at? Like, why have, if any language could become a functional language, why have functional programming languages?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic question. I would claim that most functional programming languages, you know, never really take off because they have terrible marketing.
Okay.
You know, the people who usually tout Clojure on the Java side,
mm-hmm.
you know, say, hey guys, it's a Lisp, it's awesome, let's do it. But if, you know, it's a Lisp isn't really the – if you've never used Lisp before, if you don't know what Lisp is, you know, it's like, okay, great. It's a flue bar. I don't think I need a flue bar, so I'm not going to pay much attention.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the problem where, you know, JavaScript and the functional aspects of JavaScript are used all the time by, you know, normal front-end developers every day. They just don't know that they're, you know – using some of these functional concepts, like, you know, passing around functions as values and so on. And so it's, I would claim a marketing problem. And F#, you know, addresses this in some ways by, you know, F# doesn't hide the fact that it's a functional language, but it's in the box in Visual Studio. And so, you know, you don't have to actively go out and seek it. It's just there. And so if you want to, you know, try it out, toe the water, it's much easier to do so.
Right, because it comes the same way your C# install comes. They're all right there.
Right. And yep, I would say JavaScript has also kind of popularized functional languages, you know, because it's, in many cases, the first functional language a lot of programmers have used, especially front-end people, or web developers. I mean, they learn JavaScript, discover that it's a, you know, that it's a functional language, and then say, oh, what other functional languages are out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so the kind of what I try to touch about touch upon in the book is, you know, explaining functional programming as these concepts that you can use as ways to view and approach problems that you face.
Yeah, all right. So I still think we may not have answered the actual the original question, which is what are functional languages particularly good at that makes them appealing for certain kinds of work?
So functional languages are described as programming in the small, opposed to other languages which are described as programming in the large.
Okay.
Or in other words, what does a language specialize in, and what's the unit of thought? Okay. So in
that's a great way C#, of putting it.
Like a mission statement for the language.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what's the typical action that you use? And in C#, you're creating classes. Okay. Right. I'm going to create this class that does this specific set of things. It has this interface. This is how you use it. That's great for composing that thing with other things to make bigger things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas functional programming, and F# specifically, is about writing functions. Not classes, not necessarily types, but functions. Here's some input data. I'm going to transform it in some way, and I'm going to return some output data.
Okay.
And so you're focusing on kind of the smallest unit of work, like an algorithm. Opposed to, you know, creating some object model and some you know, set of types that all, you know, interweave to compose some larger system.
Okay, so I think because
because of this, functional programming languages tend to focus on, you know, data or large data sets, you know, numeric computations, things that don't require that just focus on, you know, crunching numbers. Essentially.
Okay, so financial data sets would be a really good example, right? You've got market data coming in that's ticking the price of all these things, and all you need to do is run that through a statistics thing and get either the number out or a series of numbers out that are different from the input numbers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, which is, I mean, because in kind of a functional world, it makes perfect sense. Here's a sequence of data. Every time we get a new piece of data, we want to execute some code, return some result. How would you do that in C#? You know, you would have the sequence iterator, enumerator, you know, sprocket that then ticks into your, you know, computer factory that then, you know, passes the data along and delegates it to some other, you know, things that just chew through this machinery. When really the idea you want to express is every time we get a piece of data, call a function.
That makes sense. And so you're in C#, you're encapsulating each of the concepts that you just exposed in an object when maybe that's not the best representation for it, right? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A way I try to sell F# mm-hmm. is to describe the, you know, the amount of friction that you have when you're writing in some other language. So think of the smallest C# program that you can write, Hello World. Okay. You need a class, a static main method, some curly braces to import, you know, the system namespace,
right.
And then it's console.writeline. That's great, but think of all these concepts that you need to be aware of just to write Hello World. You need to know how to create a class, what a static method is, how to import a namespace, and put a semicolon at the end of a line. Okay.
Yeah.
In F# you write print Hello World.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. And actually, the Hello World program you described in C# is a leaky abstraction over how computers work, right? Because of the static method specifically, right? It's exposing the underlying nature of the computer, which is that the computer doesn't know what objects are at all. This is a model that we've placed on top of the computer so that human beings can reason about it better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think another good example for our people who don't work in financial services data is that a particle system for a video game. So the idea is like you've got a scene you're trying to render, and there's effects happening all over, like smoke or sparks and things like this are happening. If every one of those was an object, it would be very memory intensive, and then packing and unpacking these objects would take a lot of compute intensive work. So instead, what you want to do is represent all of the particles in a single array or data block or a vector, whatever terminology you want to use, and then apply a transform function over it that calculates gravity, calculates all these things, and returns the new position of the object all in one. And so that is actually very good as a functional programming method where you have just huge amounts of data.
I've always felt like the difference in functional programming for me is that it seems like they're all little gears or sprockets in a machine, and you're constructing each one individually, as opposed to kind of these larger, these kind of heavy objects in more object-oriented programming. But,
And the key thing to note is once you have all these kind of little individual functions that do one specific thing, you can then compose them to create more sophisticated abstractions and build them into some larger system. Right. It's not that you in functional programming, you only focus on writing, one simple function, but it's you kind of do one specialize in one little thing and then compose them to make more advanced kind of transformations.
OK. So functional programming has been a concept for a long time in computers. I mean, since the 1960s, I believe. So there's obviously a lot of history here around functional programming. And F-sharp, in some ways, is just the most modern of the functional programming languages. It's the most recent to come about. And so I was wondering if you could talk about maybe ML and OCaml and those the things that have sort of inspired F-sharp and why they're there.
Sure. So F-sharp is based on a programming language called OCaml or ML, and actually a subset of OCaml cross-compiles with F-sharp.
Oh, I did not know that.
Small ML programs are valid F-sharp programs.
Okay.
But all this goes back to, the 60s with Lisp, which started, what was kind of the first big functional programming language. And then before that, it was just, the Lambda calculus. Mm-hmm. And so all this, functional programming jazz goes back to a disagreement between Alan Turing and Alonzo Church to give you a history lesson. Okay, so in the 30s and 40s, we had these adding machines, but no one knew how to kind of reason with them. How do you think about, writing a program? Okay, and Alan Turing thought that the way to write a program was to start with the hardware, what the machine can do, and add abstractions until it's kind of reasonable for a human to operate it. And this is kind of the philosophy of imperative programs and, say, C. Okay. This is how I update, load and store values in memory, and I'm just going to keep on, stamping away until my program exits. Now, Alonzo Church, on the other hand, thought about it from the other way. We start with just the math. What's the raw idea we want to express, and we'll add constraints until it's feasible to fit onto a computer. So here's this operation that I want to conform. I want to square a number. Okay, so I will, multiply a number by itself. Great. But, how do you represent that number on a machine? Well, then you get into all the details about, floating point values and memory layout and so on and so forth.
Right, that are machine specific. Right.
Yeah, and so, when McCarthy created Lisp in the 60s, Lisp doesn't really have this notion of primitive types and how large they are and this and that. It's just about expressing an idea. Here's a function, it calls these other functions and updates, this and that, but it's not about, the pushing bits around. And so, the Alan Turing won, okay? We use programming languages with like an imperative history. However, I'm just kind of ranting at this point.
Sure.
The functional programming languages are kind of having this renaissance, if you will, with Clojure or Scala or in the Java world or F-sharp on .NET, because it's very difficult to write good parallel programs using the imperative style.
Yes.
And the functional programs or functional programming really is amenable to that. And to tout one of F-Sharp's strengths, it has a language feature called asynchronous workflows, which makes writing asynchronous and parallel programs much easier than, say, C-Sharp.
Did this turn into this async stuff that's in C-Sharp 5?
I wouldn't say it turned into it, but it's okay. Very very similar concepts.
Oh, right, you know, on.
So the way that C-Sharp implemented it is, if you look at the details of how F-Sharp did its computation expressions, which is the kind of underlying language feature that enables its async workflows, you can see how they're related. Whereas C-Sharp's is specifically about, here's how we deal with async, F-Sharp has this cool language feature that happens to also enable, you know, easy asynchronous programming.
And that makes sense, because if you don't have shared memory and you don't have side effects, then tasks become much easier to parallelize, right? You just take your list and break it. If you have four cores on your computer, you break it into four and apply the same function to all four, knowing that you're not going to change the state. And then you join the result back together at the end. And that is a much... thinking about async programming as tasks that you are sending off to the computer, to the processor, seems like a much better model than all of this mutex shared state stuff that we have right now, right, in procedural.
That's true, but I think that the value that F-Sharp asynchronous workflows have you can write immutable objects and, you know, lock-free programs and C-Sharp. I think the, you know, specifics of this F-Sharp language feature is that it does makes the asynchronous calls and callbacks seamless. If you had several asynchronous operations that you wanted to thread together, so you do this as soon as that operation completes, execute this callback, then do this other operation, pass that other callback. You end up kind of there's the code you want to write. Let's say it's 50 lines. You have to cut it up into 10 line segments that are the callbacks for, you know, every single asynchronous operation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, F-Sharp asynchronous workflows allows you to just stitch those together so you write the original 50 lines that you wanted to write. And there's some compiler syntactic sugar to do the transformation to actually create the callbacks behind the scenes.
That's beautiful, actually.
Yeah. So it's a little bit more, you know, complicated than, you know, you'd want to hear about on a podcast, but
sure,
I encourage you to check it out.
All right.
Seems like it would make event-driven programming kind of easier to conceptualize in a functional or in that asynchronous callback style.
Yep, absolutely. There's built-in libraries in F-Sharp to do that sort of thing, and, you know, people have written some cool apps, taking advantage of it.
So besides these asynchronous workflows, is there anything that really stands out about F-Sharp versus other functional programming languages that you know about?
Yes. There's one huge thing that, you know, really, I think, blows all the other functional programming languages out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it may not sound like much at first, but it's Visual Studio. All right.
Yay.
So there are a large number of other functional languages that have been around longer, maybe have larger communities or more vocal communities or whatever. One of the reasons that functional programming has never really taken off is that, you know, there just aren't good tools, libraries, and developers out there. And, you know, the biggest thing that F-Sharp has going for it as a selling point is Visual Studio. It's in the box. There's a debugger. There's all sorts of libraries. You can interoperate with your existing .NET code. You know, it all just works. And that, I think, being able to take advantage of the whole .NET stack is, I think, for me, the most exciting part of F-Sharp, because it's, you know, taking a functional programming language in this concept, you know, out of whatever dark corner that it previously was hiding in.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, brings it to, you know, the developer, the greater developer community.
And in order to get that level of interoperability, that means that F-Sharp has to have static typing, because the .NET framework
yes.
is statically typed. And so that makes F-Sharp a little different than Lisp, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Are you in the static typing camp versus dynamic duck typing?
I'm actually more of a fan of the of Go's approach to typing, which is duck typing. To talk about F-sharp, it's very, very statically typed. Okay, F-sharp loves types. In fact, it's type inferred. So you just has type inference for nearly everything, and you only need to provide type information when the compiler can't figure it out for you, which is kind of a nice touch. But at the same time, that means that you think about F-sharp in the same sort of way that you write Java or C-sharp, opposed to JavaScript or Python, where the dynamic type system does a little bit of magic behind the scenes for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the proponents that I hear most about functional programming is that some of these, because of the lambda calculus aspect and it coming from the mathematics, they're actually provably correct, many algorithms. You can say, like, given that this doesn't have side effects, do this, and you can do a formal mathematical proof to do that. I think some people created an operating system in Haskell that if the model of the hardware underneath is correct, then the OS is provably will never seg fault.
Wow.
Is F-sharp like that? Provable? Is it provable like Haskell?
It is not. And here's my proof. Anything you can do in C-sharp, you can do in F-sharp.
Okay.
Which includes the things that you shouldn't be doing in the first place.
All right. There we go.
QED.
One of the most difficult concepts that people have when they first come to functional programming is monads. I was wondering if you can help us understand monads, what they are and what they're useful for.
Yes, help me understand monads.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking me this question. If I do no other service to the world, it is to rally against the misuse of the term monads.
Okay.
F-sharp has a feature called computation expressions, which you can think of conceptually as monads, or for those in the know, monoids in the category of endofunctors. But as it turns out, nobody knows what that means. Okay. And they shouldn't need to. Yeah. It's one of these weird mathematical concepts that somebody much smarter than me, figured out and then also applied it to programming and found that it was useful.
Mm-hmm.
But people keep on throwing around this term monad and all of this, mathematical baggage, and it just makes things very confusing. And so whenever I see someone talk about functional programming and they say like, yeah, and you can learn about monads and monads do this and that, and it just makes it more difficult to approach when really it's just a design pattern. Like that's all it is. Okay. If someone says, hey, we're going to use a monad for that, you should hear in the back of your mind, design pattern.
Okay.
It's just like if someone said, hey, we'll use a singleton or we'll use an adapter or a flyweight or whatever. That's all it is. Okay. So, don't just take a deep breath. It's nothing to be intimidated by. And what monads and the pattern that monads are all about is about function composition. Specifically, how do you compose functions that have differing return types versus what the next function in the chain accepts?
Okay.
So let's say you had a function A that took an int and returned a string, and a function B that took an int and returned a string. You couldn't compose these two functions to have, A of B of some integer.
Right, because the input type is int and the return type is string.
Exactly. And so monads are all about is allowing you as the programmer to insert a little function call in between each part where you compose functions together. So this function could be, in this case, converting that string result into an integer.
Right. ATOI or something.
And now you can compose these functions together. And this sounds like a very simple concept, but it's actually very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
So earlier we were talking about F-sharp's asynchronous workflows and how it dramatically made asynchronous programming easier. And all that is an application of this pattern. Because if you want to write asynchronous code as if it were synchronous, well, you can't, because there's an asynchronous function call returns back an object that will return a value eventually, but you have to, you know, wait until that operation completes.
Right.
And so the kind of little monadic glue that you put in between these two functions is wait for this asynchronous operation to complete. When it does, resume execution.
Oh, that makes sense.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And that's the trick for that pattern. That's how F# asynchronous workflows work. But this pattern is, you know, general in other areas as well. And F# has syntax support for allowing you to write whatever type of computation expression that you want. And so Haskell relies on this, the Haskell programming language relies on this pattern quite heavily for doing things like side effects or, you know, printing to the screen, writing to files, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, you know, and the proper technical term is, well, this is a monad, sir. That's what we're doing. But for you know, normal people, mere mortals, just it's a design pattern like right. any other.
A function that goes between the two. Awesome. That was actually a very good explanation. I think that, yes, you have done some good in the world, Chris. Yes.
All right, good.
Sure.
You were going to ask me what I do with the Goog.
I was going to say that... You left Microsoft, I think, just before the release of Visual Studio 2010, and you joined the Google. And I was wondering if you can talk at all about what you do there.
Yes, I do all sorts of stuff. I've worked on Google's core search engine to Google Plus, and now I am working on Google Code.
Oh, okay.
Where I'm very excited. So ever since I joined Google, I wanted to do developer tools because, you know, that's what's very exciting to me. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a very awesome project, which, you know, I'll keep hush hush.
sure.
And what I'll kind of my mission for Google Code is to generally bring all the developer tools that we use at Google internally, externally, and show them to the world.
So is this things like Dart?
Not things. Like Dart, I'm talking about, you know, code review systems, bug tracking, how to search code, you know, what's the build system like? As it turns out, one of the most awesome parts about working at Google is just the developer infrastructure. Like, I cannot speak about how awesome it is. You know, maybe the area where I worked in Microsoft just somehow wasn't as awesome as the rest of the world, but. Mm-hmm.
Well, you and I both worked in DevDiv and Visual Studio, and I can tell you that basically at Microsoft, the philosophy is that every team can figure out build systems and how to code software the best for themselves. But my understanding is that at Google, it's all uniform. Everybody does the same thing.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, for example, there's the Google coding style guide.
Okay.
So if you write C++, Java, Python, you know, any language, there's the one way to format your code. And some people look at that with disdain and say, oh my God, that's awful. And some people, like myself, think it is amazing because you can look at any piece of source code in the code base and just can reason with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, the style guide has essentially said, you can no longer argue about inconsequential things like tabs versus spacing. You may only argue about things that matter, like the structure, you know, how you actually write code, which is great. And, you know, on top of that, there's, you know, not each team or division figures out how they build or run tests. There's here's just this amazing tool for, you know, doing your builds in the clouds, how to, you know, automatically run your tests, you know, all the time and know which specific check-in at which specific time broke which specific test. And so on and so forth. It's amazing. And so I'm very excited to try to bring as much of that as I can to, you know, the external world and hopefully, you know, make some progress on that.
Yeah, you guys have done well standardizing. I know at LiquidNet we use the Google coding standards for C++ and our C++ code. You guys have released some protocol buffers and things like that that you use internally that I think have helped a lot of people. So that's great.
Yeah, I've always appreciated that about Google that kind of sort of noble willingness to share tools and share knowledge with, you know, just with anyone. I don't know. And I think that just comes from its engineering roots.
There's one thing I'd like to add on, you know, some of these Google tools is there's one that in particular that I use all the time that I really enjoy that doesn't seem to have a lot of notoriety, and that's the Google Clojure compiler and library, which is perhaps the worst named thing out there.
Okay.
But it's a JavaScript compiler.
Worse than Google Play?
Adds... No.
Zing.
Zing!
sorry, go ahead.
It's a JavaScript compiler that actually extends the JavaScript language. And it seems wild. So, you know, the Clojure libraries add namespaces. You know, you can mm-hmm. write, you know, this file exports the following types. It expects these other types. And then when you run it through the Clojure compiler, it will, you know, read the entire code base, figure out the order in which things are needed, and remove, you know, dead code, minify source. It will read comments and annotations that you've provided to do type checking, you know, in the compiler level.
That's nice.
You can avoid some set or classes of errors, you know, in JavaScript at runtime. And so, like,
does it do documentation as well, kind of like JSDoc or? I thought I'd heard somewhere that it actually took like JSDoc syntax or, but I don't know. I haven't really used either extensively. So,
there is a tool to if you look for the like Google Clojure library reference or something.
No, maybe you can put a link in the show notes.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I can provide you the link. It's kind of this nice website that shows all the documentation for the Clojure library, and that's just from a tool that crawls the Clojure source code.
Ah. Well, that's cool. So the compiler knows about browser differences and compatibility and can rewrite code so that it works on IE6 and works on Chrome and works on Firefox.
That is my understanding. I reserve the right to be wrong.
Yes. Okay. Cool. All right, I'm going to try and bring back the pro tip segment awesome. In our podcast so that we can end in a better way. So this week, my pro tip is about an interview that I read with Alan Kay, where he's just trashing web programmers. He's like this genius programmer and stuff. He's got a lot to say about computing programming in general. But one of my favorite lines in there is that we're reinventing the flat tire. I wish we were reinventing the wheels, because then we'd be getting somewhere. It's just awesome. He's so angry at the computer programming world. And so I'll have a link to that in our show notes.
Nice. My pro tip this week is, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes as well, is the JS Hotline. I think it's jshotline.com mm-hmm. or .org. And it's an actual phone line that's staffed by JavaScript experts who are just volunteering to have you call them and ask them JavaScript questions. You're like, you know, I'm stuck. I have a problem. Who can I, you know, and you can actually just, you know, call this line or, you know, maybe there's a Skype too. I don't know. And and ask your question to a real JavaScript expert.
As far as I've seen, when you go to the website, you can see how many people are on call. Right? And it's always the one guy who I think started the JS Hotline.
Probably so.
But he's there. And sometimes Sarah Chips, she's a developer here in New York City.
I saw three or four of them online the other day. Yeah, it was like... I'm not sure if you get to pick who you talk to or how that works, but it's pretty cool. It's a really neat idea. I think more there should be more hotlines like
this. More hotlines. Yeah. I'm all for more hotlines. Chris, were you able to come up with anything?
Give yourself license to fail in learning any new task. You will be terrible at first, but once you get over that learning curve, you will be much better and much happier. For example, I spent all week trying to learn sed, grep, find, and other Unix power tools, It has made my life so much better.
I love grep.
I'm not so much with the sed. That's the one that edits in. You can pipe to sed and then edit the stream in line using a regular expression.
Yep.
But grep, find, yes. Yes. I got those.
I've never used sed. I don't even know.
Actually, pipe is like the most incredible Unix pipe. Command, right? Like,
it's awesome. Yeah.
Pipe. And when you set one up, you're feel so good.
It doesn't even have an English name. It's just a character.
Yeah. All right. Great pro tip. This has been a great show. Thank you very much for being on, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Is there anything other than your book that you want to plug?
I have a word of warning. Stay away from Diablo 3. It is. It will ruin your memories of Diablo 2.
Hmm. I had no memories of Diablo 2, but I, like you, well, I at least last week or so have stopped playing.
I'm sure I've started to hear some horror stories about the market and all, you know, the real world currency and stuff. And like they like it's nothing drops good items anymore because they want you to go to the,
go to the auction house, right? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I never confuse malfunction.